U.S. President-elect Donald Trump's choice for the head of the U.S. military begins his confirmation hearing.
Other than the president, no official plays a larger role in telling the men and women in uniform, the Congress and the public, about the threats we face and the need for a peace through strength defense policy.
What is the new administration's policy for the U.S. Armed Forces?
I think the Trump administration has a notable lack of vision or ideas for the Defense Department beyond this sort of anti-wokeness or diversity, equity, and inclusion agenda.
Today is Tuesday, January 14th, and this is The Issue from VOA.
Hi, everyone. I'm Lori London.
And I'm Scott Walterman.
The strength of our military is our unity and our shared purpose, not our differences.
President-elect Donald Trump's choice for Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth called himself a change agent in an opening statement at his Senate confirmation hearing.
The DEI policies of today are not the same as what happened back then. They're dividing troops inside formations, causing commanders to walk on eggshells, not putting meritocracy first. That's the indictment that's made by those serving right now.
Excuse me.
And why we're having this conversation.
Among the objections the opposition has with Hegseth are his statements that women shouldn't be allowed in combat roles. Democratic Senator Kirsten Gillibrand.
We have hundreds of women who are currently in the infantry, lethal members of our military serving in the infantry, but you degrade them. You say, we need moms, but not in the military, especially in combat units.
Now, Hegseth says he wasn't against women in combat if they could meet the same standard as men.
And so whether it's a man or a woman, they have to meet the same high standards. And Senator, in any place where those things have been eroded or in courses, criteria have been changed in order to meet quotas, racial quotas or gender quotas, that is putting a focus on something other than readiness, standards, meritocracy, and lethality. So that's the kind of review I'm talking about, not whether women have access to ground combat.
Reuters correspondent Freddie Joyner tells us more about Hegseth.
After graduating from Princeton in 2003, Hegseth served in Afghanistan, Iraq, and Guantanamo Bay as an Army National Guard officer, earning 2 Bronze Stars. In 2013, he received a master's from Harvard University. But the former Fox News personality has been criticized for lacking the management experience needed to lead 1.3 million active duty service members and the nearly 1 million civilians who work for the nation's military. Since Trump tapped Hegseth for the job, allegations of alcohol abuse and sexual misconduct emerged. A California police report showed a woman filed a sexual assault complaint against him in 2017. Hegseth was never charged and has denied any wrongdoing. He has also denied allegations of excessive drinking and financial mismanagement at veterans organizations. He was bombarded with questions about these accusations during a meeting with senators back in December on Capitol Hill.
You misspent funds, mistreated women, were intoxicated on the job. Do you have any comment about that reporting at all?
Hey guys, we're not doing questions.
It's like a gaggle in the locker room.
So that article suggests you have an alcohol problem.
Okay, thank you guys.
Despite allegations of misconduct in his private and personal life, Trump has reiterated his support for Hegseth. Hegseth spent much of the past few weeks in the Senate, meeting with Republican senators whose support he must win to secure the 51 yes votes he will need to be confirmed to lead the Pentagon. To date, there has been no public announcement that any Republican will not vote for Hegseth. The Armed Services Committee will vote on Hegseth's nomination after hearing his testimony, sending it for consideration for the full Senate.
Reuters correspondent Freddie Joyner.
And Scott, this was just the first of many, many more hearings that will be taking place this week, next week, and beyond for President-elect Trump's picks. And certainly this one is one of those roles that has really enormous responsibility.
Well, there are people that say the Department of Defense is the number one department in the U.S. government, strictly sometimes just, well, I mean, aside from the fact that it's the Army and the Navy and the Air Force, it's got a huge, giant budget. It's $900 $1 billion and millions of employees in the Army and the Navy and the Air Force.
Right.
And the Coast Guard and the Space Force and civilian employees.
Imagine
and
that many people to oversee. That's a lot.
It's a lot of people.
Indeed. Well, joining us now is Ben Friedman. He is a policy director with Defense Priorities to talk about it.
Thank you so much for being able to join us today.
Thanks for having me on.
So, new administration, new goals for the Department of Defense. Can you give us a big picture overview of how you think the new Trump administration wants to move the DOD?
I think the Trump administration has a notable lack of vision or ideas for the Defense Department beyond this sort of anti-wokeness or diversity, equity, and inclusion agenda that they have. So they, by nominating Hegseth, Trump signaled unsurprisingly that, you know, he has an interest in going after some of the so-called wokeness programs and maybe promoting people differently than the Biden administration would have within the military based on some effort to weed out people who are seen as overly interested in, you know, promoting wokeness, and they may roll back some training programs around diversity training and things of that nature. That seems to be the biggest thing that Hegseth stands for as a nominee in DOD, and it's consistent with the general Republican agenda, I think, for defense. But what's lacking, I think, is any kind of larger vision for what they want, for what the Trump administration wants the Department of Defense to do. It's not even clear that Trump wants to throw money at defense, which he did last time. Even that, there wasn't much discussion of that in the campaign. It's a reasonable hypothesis that that's what they'll wind up doing. But I don't know what the nominee Hegseth thinks about the defense budget particularly, or moving money around within it, what he thinks about shipbuilding and submarines versus surface ships. I'm not sure even what he thinks about the various places the U.S. has troops deployed, including in quasi-war zones like Syria. There's been a remarkably small amount of talk about that from Trump, and prior to today, at least, from Hegseth. So it's all a bit mysterious what the agenda is, and we're left to sort of grasp at straws and signals.
My understanding is that he has vowed to restore, quote, warrior culture at the Pentagon. What do you see that might mean, a warrior culture?
That's pretty vague. It clearly has something to do with going after wokeness and trying to focus on training programs that are about more traditional military readiness and organized violence. I mean, it's not like the Department of Defense got out of that business, but I suppose, again, it means maybe rolling back some more training programs that seem focused on social inclusion or things of that nature. And Hegseth seems to have backed off his positions taken as books and other places where he was critical of women in combat. At least it doesn't seem like they're looking to do anything differently on that front at the moment. I also worry that, you know, promoting warrior culture means being tolerant of war crimes, which was something Hegseth was big on when he was at Fox, you know, in getting Trump when he was president before to pardon or otherwise excuse people who had committed war crimes or being prosecuted. I hope that's not the case. But certainly by nominating Hegseth, who's known for that, I think it does send a sort of signal about potentially send a signal about tolerance of people who commit war crimes or war crimes themselves, which is an unfortunate one to send.
As I listened to the hearing today, he kept talking about the standard, that the standard has been lowered over the course of time for DEI, for inclusion, and that in order to bring women into positions that they formerly did not have, like combat roles, standards had to be lowered, and he wants those standards to be raised again to where they were previously. Is there any truth to any of that?
I think formally, no, they haven't changed the standards. It's just that women, you know, have to meet the same standards as men, is my understanding, in combat roles. So that doesn't, I don't think it's true.
What specifically would you say are the main responsibilities of someone in the position of U.S. Defense Secretary?
Well, it's the world's hardest management job, perhaps, maybe even harder than being president of the United States, in that, you know, the Department of Defense is really, because it's such a huge department, it's a bunch of different fiefdoms, starting with the military services, which have considerable power and sway on Capitol Hill, and that makes them hard to manage because it's also a mixture of military officers and civilians and contractors that creates management challenges. And the primary thing that the Secretary of Defense does is manage that job. And there's a somewhat well-known article that says it's basically an impossible job. You know, the budget is the main tool you have to do that. And I think the big concern about Hegseth, independent of his ideology or political beliefs, is that he just has remarkably little experience for someone nominated to the job in managing anything really big, let alone a government agency like the Department of Defense. So it's going to be difficult for him to do the job that's difficult for anyone to do. It's going to be particularly difficult for him. And he's going to have to rely a lot on deputies. But even his top deputy, the top nominated deputy, is not an experienced person in DOD. So the Trump administration doesn't value experience in management. And I think that for their agenda and their beliefs, that's probably going to wind up being a mistake.
He was talking about Silicon Valley. And for the first time, he said, for the very first time ever, Silicon Valley was amenable to working with the Department of Defense, and that was really one of the main battle fronts of the future. Did you hear that when he said that, or can you talk about that?
I didn't hear that, but I think that it's unsurprising. There's been a lot of talk about these people from the tech industry coming into the Trump administration and this desire to shift away from the big contractors to newer ones who are more focused on AI and other newer technologies. And I suppose that is probably or likely to be, if he's confirmed, something that Hegseth works on, is shifting the contracts maybe to some newer actors or shifting more of the contracts to these newer actors and the focus on emerging technologies. But I don't think he's well equipped to do that off the bat. He's going to need a lot of help. And, you know, I think the military services might be quite resistant to that, given that they tend to have a pretty good idea what they want to do, at least for the, you know, the big contracts, and are probably going to be comfortable working with the more established players for the most part.
He was also asked about President Trump's plans for immigration and deportation. Is it possible that our military will shift to some degree to have different responsibilities?
I think it's unlikely that there's a major shift. In part because, regardless of the desires of the Trump administration, you know, there's going to be a major institutional resistance to that. The active duty military is really not interested in having some role in domestic policing or anti-immigration.
they have a pretty good idea what their mission is and a lot of political support for it, and they don't, I think, want to shift it. The law is more flexible, I think, than we often realize, posse comitatus being more of something that's honored as a kind of norm than a really hard and fast restriction. But there may be, you know, some role for the National Guard at the border. You know, that's not new. It would be pretty shocking and worrisome if they were used to sort of augment ICE and be involved in rounding up or finding, undocumented people, illegal immigrants. So I think that's something to watch and from my perspective, potentially worry about, the erosion of distinction between domestic politics and domestic policy and what the military traditionally does is not something I think we want to erode. And beyond that, I think even, if the Trump administration wants to do a big deportation effort, as many say they do, it's not clear that they can't just use the resources they have, in the Department of Homeland Security to do it. It seems like using the military is more of a kind of a statement about how serious they are than an actual kind of necessity that has some kind of operational logic behind it.
A lot of the people that listen to this show are outside the United States. I was wondering if you could just give us a big picture description of just how big and diverse this department is. Things like, I always think of the B-1 bomber, right? When President Carter tried to kill that project, and the military had learned that if you build a little piece of that airplane in as many congressional districts as you possibly can, you'll never get the votes to kill it. It's that military-industrial complex that Eisenhower warned about before he left office that really is a giant industry.
Yeah, well, defense spending is about a little bit over 3% of GDP now in the United States, and that's a lot lower than it was at various points, almost any point in the past. But that's not a reflection of the fact that we don't spend a ton on the military anymore. It's a reflection of the fact that the economy has grown so much that 3% of GDP is more than $800 billion a year. And that remains a very important part of the economy, and particularly in certain states and congressional districts, bases, but particularly production lines, contractors are a huge political constituency. Beyond their sheer economic power, I think it's the fact that it's a concentrated interest. That is, the people who benefit from that government spending, the organizations, defense contractors, unions of workers, and all the people who have employment or some kind of material interest in that endeavor, secondary contractors and even people who deliver food and do construction, they kind of know who they are. They know that they're benefiting from that contractor or from that base. So they tend to be very active politically and organized to prevent, the closure and, congressional delegations from certain states, will be remarkably focused on what it takes to keep their production facilities open. You always have senators from Maine because of Bath Iron Works, for example, sort of advocating on behalf of the Navy and shipbuilding. That's sort of the nature of a federal system like we have in the United States. It's impossible really to get rid of. I mean, it can be mitigated, but a consequence of that is that the military services and contractors who work for them have a lot of sway in Congress and have their own kind of relationships. And so being the president of the United States or the secretary of defense who works for the president, you have a surprisingly limited amount of control over the people who are supposedly subordinate to you because they have these relationships to Congress. That's part of this military-industrial complex idea. It's just sort of there are these special interests that have very important political constituencies.
It is definitely the dictionary definition of herding cats, is it not?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Ben, thank you.
That's what makes the job kind of impossible.
Thank you so much.
We appreciate your taking the time.
Yeah. No problem.
That was Ben Friedman, Policy Director with Defense Priorities.
So we'll see how this plays out. It's hard to tell from confirmation hearings anymore because, you know, they didn't really talk about as much policy as you would expect in the hearing. It was really the two sides lining up to make their points, the Republicans and the Democrats. So things have changed in that regard in the confirmation process. It's become much more partisan than it used to be. And you really don't talk about the department that he's going to run. Didn't talk about Iran, didn't talk about the Middle East, didn't talk about the things that you would think they would question the new potential Secretary of Defense about. It was really about defending his positions on the right and attacking his positions from the left.
Right. Definitely a strong partisan divide, and I would imagine many more of these upcoming hearings will sort of be similar. Sort of the lines have been drawn.
Sort of the new where we are.
You know?
Yeah,
yeah,
it's where
I mean,
we are.
We had a Democratic president and
now we have a Republican president, right. And ne'er the twain shall meet, I guess.
Well, we can only hope.
You've been listening to The Issue from The Voice of America.
On behalf of all of us here at VOA in Washington and around the world, we thank you so much for joining us.
You can follow The Issue on X, Blue Sky, and Facebook at VOA The Issue. And for news 24/7, go to our website, voanews.com.
In Washington, I'm Lori London.
And I'm Scott Walterman.
We'll talk to you tomorrow.